Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. In this episode, Simon Singh, author of the bestseller Fermat's Last Theorem, digs into the mathematical secrets embedded in The Simpsons. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create for a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Chicago, Amsterdam, London, and Copenhagen, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, good very late night. Welcome to the GoTo Book Club. This is in real life. All the previous book clubs have been online. So in real life from the Code Node in London. And my name's Kevlin Henney. I'm joined here by Simon Singh, who has an incredible list of publications and broadcasting credits to his name. Starting with Fermat's Last Theorem, an award-winning Horizon program in the mid-90s that Simon directed and basically tracks the story of Andrew Wiles' a wonderful proof and the human story behind it. But from there, Simon's gone on to explore cryptography in the code book, the beginnings of everything in the Big Bang, and then basically something much more personal on a day-to-day level, our health and well-being, Trick or Treatment, a book that investigated alternative medicine. But what we're going to really try and talk about for most of this discussion is The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, which is, well, how can I put it? That might be one of the most excellent nerdy crossovers. You're appealing to such a demographic there.
Yeah, no, it's you know, I love The Simpsons and I love maths, and mathsy people tend to like The Simpsons as well. And so when the idea came to me, when I realized there was this maths embedded in The Simpsons, and not just one or two examples, but throughout the series, season after season, episode after episode, it was an irresistible book to write. It was a joy. It was a joy to write.
Yeah, and I think that the what I find absolutely fascinating about this is that the internet loves a good conspiracy. It actually likes quite a few bad ones as well. But here is something hiding in plain sight that only relatively few people kind of caught on to.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that I've written this book called Fermat's Last Theorem, and I made a film about Fermat's Last Theorem, and I was watching The Simpsons. And there was a clear reference to Fermat's Last Theorem. It was, and all of these references are background references. They're in passing. You know, if you blink, you'll miss them. Sometimes they're known as freeze frame gags, and that you have to pause the video before you can notice them. But I'd noticed here is a clear and direct reference to Fermat's Last Theorem. In fact, it was an equation in Treehouse of Horror 6, I think. Where it says some number to the 12th power plus another number to the 12th power equals a third number to the 12th power, which is impossible. It cannot exist. Fermat's Last Theorem says this combination of numbers is impossible. And so I got in touch with the writers. I had no idea how I would do it, but I emailed David X. Cohen, who people will know as a writer of The Simpsons, but also sort of one of the driving forces behind Futurama. And I just sent him this email, had no idea whether he'd ever get it or whether he'd ever reply. But he came straight back to me and said, yeah, sure, that was one of my references, in fact. And I said, oh, one of your references? You mean there's a lot of them there? And he said, yeah. And he explained that his background was in physics and then computer science. And he'd written academic maths papers and been published. He wasn't the only mathematician. There were many mathematicians. Ken Keeler has a PhD in applied maths from Harvard. Jeff Westbrook was a professor at Yale. J. Stuart Burns was doing a PhD at Berkeley in maths. And all these people gave up their maths to become comedy writers. But they still love maths. And so the way they express their love of maths is by hiding these little equations or references in the show. And so that's an irresistible book. At that point, you just have to write about the maths that's in The Simpsons and the writers. That was it.
And I think that I mean, particularly, I mean, that your eyes are clearly sensitized to this because of Fermat's Last Theorem. And I did write it down.
Right.
That the numbers, just for anybody that's watching and would like to check this on their calculator, don't do it in Python because you'll discover that this might not actually work the way you think it does. 3987 to the 12th plus 4365 to the 12th equals 4472 to the 12th in apparent violation and contradiction of Fermat's Last Theorem.
And if you check that on a simple calculator, probably a 10-digit calculator, it sort of seems to work because it almost works. It's a near-miss solution. Yeah. But obviously a near-miss solution is not good enough. And if you have a proper display or a proper computer, you'll see that there's a discrepancy. There were actually two examples of this in The Simpsons. It might have been the Treehouse of Horror example. You actually have an odd power plus an odd number to the 12th power plus an even number to the 12th power equaling an even number to the 12th power. And so just by parity, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
So you don't need to get your calculator out. And so David X. Cohen repeated the gag in, there was an episode where Homer wanted to become an inventor. And he was in his basement scrawling on a blackboard. And then you have a more convincing example, which was there.
And it's just these little bits and pieces. The fact that I didn't realize that, yes, of course, they went back and did the joke better.
Yes.
So found better numbers. So this kind of, like, this is a level of calling to writing a good script that goes beyond just like, yeah, that seems like a good line, let's throw it in there. I mean, to go around hunting for 12 powers, that requires somebody going away, typing in a bit of code,
there's another example where Marge, in an episode, Marge and Homer turn a couple play, where Marge and Homer cancel Tabitha Vicks and her husband, the baseball player Buck Mitchell, who are having problems in their marriage. And, by the end of the episode, Tabitha's back in love with her husband and her husband's in love with her. And she appears on the jumbo vision screen. And she tells the crowd how much she loves her husband. And there are these three numbers on the jumbo vision screen. And then the question for the crowd is, what's the crowd today? Is it three numbers, which I will try not to remember in case I get them wrong.
Oh, it's okay. I've got them written down here. Because, yes, 8191.
Right.
8128 and then 8208.
Fine. Well, so the first one is a Mersenne prime. So not just any old prime, but a Mersenne prime, a really nice prime. The second number is a perfect number. And there are this relationship between perfect numbers and Mersenne prime. So these aren't just interesting numbers. They're interesting numbers that have interesting relationships. And then the third one is a narcissistic number. So again, it's not just a case of, let's just pick a number that people find interesting. It's a case of finding interesting relationships between numbers as well.
Yeah, and I think that because I think for a lot of people that they're familiar with some of the relationships, and certainly for some people who care in the computer science space, Mersenne primes are important. There's a random number generator, the Mersenne twister, that is based off that.
Right.
But normally, if you ask a software developer to come up with a bunch of numbers around 8,000, they would typically choose powers of two.
Right.
It says 8192. We wouldn't choose. And the fact that there's perfect numbers, that's absolutely fantastic. But the narcissistic number, I had not heard of that.
Yeah, no, it was new to me as well, completely new to me. And so this is, I think 371 is a nice example because it's got three digits. You raise each digit to the third power. So 3 to the 3 plus 7 to the 3 plus 1 to the 3 equals 371. So the number regenerates itself. It's almost as if it's in love with itself. So therefore, it's a narcissistic number. So yeah, and I think there was a turning point. I think to start with, the writers from the get go. So people like Mike Reiss, who worked on the very first series of The Simpsons. When he was a teenager, he was writing to Martin Gardner. The people may remember the great popularizer and puzzle genius and mathematician. And he would write about maths questions to Martin Gardner. So you had people like that who really loved maths, and then you had people like Al Jean, who was such a brilliant young mathematician. I think he went to Harvard when he was sort of 15 or 16. Yeah. And so they were there from the get-go, and they put in these odd bits of maths, and I think it was just for their own pleasure. They didn't think anybody would notice. But then as the internet grew and as there were forums where people would say, hey, hang on, I think I spotted this reference to Fermat's Last Theorem, then the writers could see that the audience were really picking up on this. And then it became much more a case of, I think the writers saying, you know what, when I was a kid, I felt a bit lonely. You know, I loved math, but maybe other people didn't. And if we can put maths in the show for those kids who are a bit like us or a bit like we used to be, then hopefully they'll think, well, you know, the writers of The Simpsons love maths. I love maths. Maybe that's a good thing to do. And so there was a point at which it went from a private joke to something they really wanted some members of the audience to appreciate.
I think that idea, there's a playfulness there, which is absolutely joyful and is actually the story of many things, whether many kinds of works, whether it is paintings or code, that people will put these little Easter eggs in, these little references. And they're not for everybody, but the person that picks up on them gets an extra reward and a delight. And the people that put it in there also get a certain kick out of it.
We're talking about the mathematicians in the team, and there are a lot of mathematicians who write for The Simpsons. But there are also, you know, people with other fascinations, and they will drop their little Easter eggs in as well for their own little audience.
So that's kind of an interesting one, because the originator of The Simpsons, Matt Groening, he's not a mathematician.
No.
But he's ended up, you know, he created the show, but then it is this subtext has taken on a life of its own.
Yeah. But there are many, many other subtexts. I'm sure there is somebody who's written a book about the philosophy of The Simpsons, and somebody else who's written a book about the economics of The Simpsons. I'm sure there are other books to be written, but I think it's shocking that there's so much maths. I think that's what was so weird about the book. And also, you know, there's the science fiction or the science of Star Trek. And that doesn't particularly surprise you. It's a science fiction show. But the maths in The Simpsons is just overwhelmingly shocking because, just the depth and the variety and the difficulty of some. You know, when there are references to pi. I think there are 6 different references to pi. And because that's something that everybody's heard of and everybody studied at school, that can appear in the dialogue. And it appears front and center at sometimes the heart of a gag. But the more obscure references, come through thick and fast, but they're much more in the background.
Yeah, I mean, stuff like, so anything to do with primes, people kind of latch on to potentially pi is a good one, but then narcissistic numbers, then there's some topology in there. There's also, and your background as a particle physicist, there's a foreshadowing, there's a calculation of the Higgs, the mass of the Higgs boson at the end of the 20th century, wasn't actually...
It was about a dozen years before the Higgs boson was discovered. I think David S. Cohen, who has a physics background, contacted one of his friends from college who was at Columbia and said, look, can you come up with an equation that looks like it might predict the mass of the Higgs? And so his friend created this equation which predicted a mass of the Higgs, which appeared in The Simpsons. And you know what? The mass that it predicted was not so far from the mass that we eventually discovered for the Higgs boson. There's all sorts of interesting maths there, all sorts of interesting physics as well, occasionally.
Yeah, and I think that the funny thing is a lot of these things, because there seems to have been enough, there's a sort of a kind of a joy in the creation. So they're putting stuff in there that is way ahead of its time in some cases. The reference to Googleplex being a classic. Yeah.
So I give talks to school kids and I show that the movie theater in Springfield, I think there are 2 movie theaters, but there's the Aztec, which closed down, and then there's the Googleplex. And I explain that the kids nowadays now know what a Googleplex is, and they go around the playground. You know, I think when I was a kid, we used to talk about infinity, and now kids talk about Googleplex as being the new big super number that other kids are not supposed to know about. But back in, I think, something like 1989, when this appeared in The Simpsons, Google, the company, didn't exist.
Yeah.
So Google, the mathematical term, was much, much more obscure. And so that's the kind of thing that was the bread and butter of the maths references early on. Very obscure back then. Now, that a lot of people would know about.
But yeah, they got in there. I mean, that's the thing. They got in there all that time ago. Yeah, I can actually remember when I learned about a Google. It was Carl Sagan's Cosmos.
Right.
And that was the one source that I had, Google and Googleplex,
right.
And I didn't see it again for a number of years.
Right.
Now it's everywhere and yep. easily discoverable. So The Simpsons is basically we should be looking at The Simpsons for what's coming up in the Nobels, and maybe, you know, the Fields Medal over the next few years. You know, if we look
Nobel
back at the last few years,
have appeared in The Simpsons after. I think the Nobel laureate for chemistry, whose name escapes me, who was in The Simpsons as a voice
Linus Pauling,
and a character.
Was it Linus Pauling?
Track The Simpsons and you'll find out.
So basically, it's all there. If people wanted to start placing bets on various things. But there's another thing here I think is again fascinating. It goes back to that idea of the, you know, why these mathematicians end up writing scripts, comedy. And, you know, I think many people are very used to the idea of interdisciplinary kind of cross-bleeding. You know, we often talk about, oh, maths and music, and we see these kind of connections and people draw it out. But this one is different. This seems a little further, I guess, until you look closer. What is it that is drawing these mathematicians to this world of comedy? What are they being, you know, what's been triggered?
Partly at The Simpsons, it's a case of, I asked each of the writers, why are there so many mathematicians here? Why is that the case? And they all came up with different reasons. One of the reasons was that comedy writing, certainly in America, is a very collaborative process. People sit down and they think about these jokes together. And they said, that's how we used to do maths at college. We used to sit around the coffee table and work through our weekly math problem sheet. So working together, an important factor. Secondly, writing comedy is intellectually really demanding.
Mm.
And so you need people who are really bright. And I guess these people are mathematicians, and that kind of makes them pretty bright. Also, you need stamina.
Mm.
You need that ability to sit down for hours and hours thinking through joke after joke and refining. And again, if you're doing maths, you need that tenacity and you need that instinct to kind of think, oh, you know, I've got this problem. Which direction am I going to go and solve it? I kind of feel it's in that direction.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it gets there. And similarly, you need to have a sense, an intuition of where the jokes, where the comedy is going to be and where the humor is going to be. Mathematicians love logic and like playing with logic and bending logic and breaking logic. And often that can lead to humor. And then Al Jean came up with this, So Al Jean said, okay, you know, all of that maybe explains why there are so many mathematicians who are comedy writers at The Simpsons. And there are lots of other mathematicians in comedy more generally. Mm. In England, people like Dave Gorman was doing a degree in maths before he gave it up to become a BAFTA-winning comedy writer, and now a top-notch cryptic crossword puzzle writer as well. That seems to be his latest fascination. And Dara O'Brien has a degree in maths and physics, and many other people that have these kind of maths backgrounds go into comedy. But Al Jean said, but the second question is, why The Simpsons? Why not another sitcom, a live action sitcom? And he felt that what mathematicians have is they have control. You know, everything they write down is perfect. You know, every number they write down is perfect. These aren't measurements with error bars and inaccuracies and dodgy observations. It's a controlled discipline. And he felt that in animation, you have that control. What you want to write, your script is there delivered the way you want it to be delivered. Whereas in live action comedy, I guess actors improvise on the day and weather conditions change and directors suddenly have an inspiration and you lose that control. So if you have that obsessive, objective view of the world that mathematicians do, then animation might be the best place to display that.
That's a really interesting one, because there is that idea of there in the performance, you can always go back and say, I could have done that one differently, or that was a good piece of improvisation.
Yeah.
And we took it this way and that way. I was watching something recently on how much of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is actually improvised. It's certainly a lot more than people expect,
right.
And a lot of their treasured moments. But then we look to this kind of more absolute truth that I guess is also is very much true in maths. I mean, a theorem once proven is, that's it. It's done. It doesn't, you know, that's not going to, nobody's going to come along and necessarily say, yes, the wind has changed and yeah, this is different, or we found something that falsifies the theory, or there's an edge case here that takes us from Newtonian to Einsteinian physics, or this kind of stuff. It's like the theorem, that's it. It's done.
G.H. Hardy said, if you want, you know, immortality may be a silly word, but if that's what you want, then being a mathematician gives you that best hope of achieving immortality. And I think he says, you know, Archimedes' name lives on for centuries, for millennia. You know, we laugh at what the Greeks said about medicine, and you know, what the Greeks said about astronomy is a bit of a joke. But what the Greeks learned about mathematics, we still teach at universities today, because it doesn't change. It's there forever.
It's interesting you mentioned the name thing. I hadn't really thought about that one, because it is, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, the names. We talk about various principles, and we are talking about, you know, there's Pythagoras. He attaches his name to something. We've got Fermi. Mm. He attaches the name. There's Goldbach, Riemann. All of these people end up with a name attached. But when I go through physics, it's not that that isn't there. It's just that it's not there as much. We tend to name it after the thing rather than the person a lot more.
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's what happens. You know, you have a Newtonian theory of gravity, and it gets overturned, or certainly gets refined by Einstein, and then Einstein's theory of gravity gets refined or overturned by what will ever come, you know, what will come next, and so
which
on.
Will be found in The Simpsons, undoubtedly. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Maths is this very, very different discipline, it's important for students to understand that maths is a fundamentally different subject. It's that beauty of proof is something that often gets lost at school. And it's one of the things I'm, you know, whenever I visit a school or whenever I talk to kids, is to kind of reinforce this idea that there is this profound beauty in proof in mathematics. It's different from any other proof in any other discipline.
Yeah, there's this, and exactly that. There is an elegance. I do remember at school when I was taught proof by induction, going like, wow, this is totally different. Everything else had been presented as is, and here was a way of demonstrating something that was somehow timeless and eternal.
Yeah, I actually remember a very similar point as well. Yeah, no, it's astonishing.
Yeah, but then we have that, and then there's this other aspect. There's I guess two other aspects I'm drawing on. One is the collaborative aspect, working towards something, bouncing ideas off something. You are constructing something, and that I think is fascinating, because that team writing that you're drawing to. Again, I suspect. Yeah, again, the why the Simpsons. I can't imagine that would have worked here in the same time in the UK, because that's not how comedy is written.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes. It's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, I think it's changing a little bit, but you know, we do have this tradition in the UK of two or three people, or one person even sitting there. Well, actually, it tends to be double acts, doesn't it? Yeah. Galton and Simpson and Ian Lefrenet and Dick Clement.
Yes.
But you do two or three or four series, and then you draw a line under it, and each series is six episodes. Whereas America, there is this view of you have a team of writers, and people come in and people come out, and you do your 15, 16 episodes, and then you do it year after year after year. Mm. And it's an industry, and it's an industry that delivers.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work the same here, or certainly didn't work that way in the past.
Yeah. There's a sort of Darwinian element to kind of like this kind of works, but it also scales. Mm. And as you say, the short run series, I mean, obviously Simpsons is an outlier here. I mean, what is it? Right at the end of 1989, so we can claim quite a few decades there. If we're going to talk 1990 as the decade boundary, it's still going.
Yes.
And Futurama went for, let me think, 15 years, 16 years. That's astonishing.
With some big gaps in the middle.
Yes, they were eight seasons or something like that. So this is remarkably successful.
Yeah, know? And again, I mean, Futurama, so I do write about Futurama in the book a bit, because a lot of those writers who are on The Simpsons worked also on Futurama, and there's a ton of science on Futurama, but there's also a huge amount of maths as well. You know, they love their math, and it's there. You know, and it was, you know, I was lucky enough that I got to go over and spend some time with the writers, spent a week there, kind of in their offices, interviewing them, but also going to table reads of the scripts, which is fascinating. I got to go to the edit suite and see new episodes of Futurama being edited and put together, you know, before they were broadcast. So it was a really remarkable time. Yes. So, I remember staying in a really dodgy motel. Such a dodgy motel.
So this is going to be a dodgy motel in LA.
Yeah, I had to sleep with my laptop in the bag under my head because there were sirens going off right next door, and it just felt really bad. And then somehow my laptop was still on, and so it started overheating, and this burning smell from my back woke me up. That's my other memory I have of spending my week with The Simpsons. But anyway,
but I mean that sounds very LA. I mean, I've seen that film, you know, or the films like it, you know, it's sort of writer goes to LA, yeah, and befalls all kinds of strange things. But you're back with us here. But I mean, but that's a hell of a story, because in one sense, you drew in, obviously when you originally contacted them, it was a case of like. This Fermat's Last Theorem thing,
yeah.
You didn't know you were going to end up writing a book. You just pulled at this thread and discovered there was a lot more. I mean, I confess, I watched The Simpsons and I thought, oh, nerd joke. Every now and then, just left it at that. And you pursued it to beyond its logical end, as it were.
But once that initial contact was made, they were very open. Scott, you know, we've had a load of stuff. Here it is. This is, look here, 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 and here. And here's some stuff we've got coming up very soon, and here's something that nobody really noticed before. So they were really generous with their time, and they put all this stuff in there, and they want the world to know about it. So they were really happy to kind of share it with me. And you know, sometimes I would just watch episodes over and over again and go back and watch old series just to try and see if there was something I'd missed so my wife, at the time, she's still my wife, but I mean, at the time, she was writing a book about a suffragette, an Indian suffragette, right, here in London. And so she would go off to the British, to the archives in Kew, and she would get these documents out and these diaries, and she'd faithfully transcribe them and take these notes, painstaking labor of love, and it took her months and months and months to get this source material together. She'd come home having done all this transcription and come in. I'd be kind of lying on the couch watching The Simpsons do my research. And I kind of, you know, I picked the right book to write.
It's research. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
I never really thought about it from that point of view. That's an absolute win. Yes. So, you know, really, everybody, for the last 18 months, whatever it is you've been doing and binge watching, that is, claim it as research.
Yeah.
You know, it's there are over three decades of Simpsons there you can now do research on. But again, you'll be diligent, because I presume you're hitting the pause key every now and then.
There are some episodes you watch again and again and again, because there's so much maths in there, and others that it's a single watch and you're on to the next one, but there's still a lot to do. Yeah.
So yeah, that's there's some kind of interesting things there about, I guess, the role of, or the presence of maths in popular culture. You know, clearly we see it in The Simpsons, which is not a program. It is a program about a dysfunctional family in one way, but a charming and wonderful family in other ways. But it has this mathematical element. But then we also see maths popping up in other places. And as you said, you know, one's not surprised by the science in Star Trek, because you kind of expect that. But we see it popping up in other places, and all these little references that are not necessarily there for everyone. And for example, there's a Fermat reference to in Doctor Who. I remember it was Matt Smith. And he makes a reference to Fermat's Last Theorem, and that's just a kind of a part. I mean, that's done in a few sentences.
I think he has to go back in time to somehow glimpse the original proof that Fermat had. So Pierre Fermat had this proof he claimed to write at the margin. He claimed to have a proof, and I think that was what Matt Smith was trying to do, was to go back in time to witness that proof in order to prove maybe that he really was the doctor. There are lots of, so Fermat pops up in lots of, isn't it? Because it's so glamorous and it's so famous. short stories where people are making deals with the devil and the devil is challenged. Well, you can take my soul as long as you can go away and prove Fermat's last theorem. And of course, the devil can't, and therefore can't steal someone's soul. The girl with the dragon tattoo, I think, starts off with the Arcadia. Lots of references to Pierre de Fermat and Fermat's last theorem. There was a whole Broadway, off-Broadway light opera. I think it'd be, or maybe just a musical, but Fermat's Last Tango, all about a mathematician going off to try and prove Fermat's last theorem. So it's lovely to see maths appearing in this way. And part of the reason for writing the Simpsons book was that I realized that Fermat's last theorem, there's a certain audience of people who will pick up a serious maths book. I think it's a very human story. And I think it's very engaging and it's written for a general audience. But I know there's only a certain group of people who will go and pick up a maths book and read it. My hope with the Simpsons book was that would reach a different audience. The maths in it is still very serious. In Fermat's Last Theorem, I talk about infinity and some of the work of David Hilbert and Cantor. But in the Simpsons book, I go one step further and talk about uncountable infinities, because that pops up in Futurama. So there are people, and teenagers in particular, who'll say, oh, if it's a Simpsons book, yeah, I'll give that a go, because I know I'm going to have Bart or Lisa holding my hand, taking me through some of the maths. And also, I think one of the mistakes I made when I started writing, when I write books, I have five big chapters, six meaty chapters in a book. That's how you write a book. I started to do that with the Simpsons book. And in fact, when I was flying over to Los Angeles to meet the writers, it just wasn't working, these big, hefty chapters. And I just rewrote the entire book in that 10-hour flight. I just rewrote it into 17, 18 chapters, which were just short and punchy and snappy, much more like a little Simpsons episode where you get in there, learn some math, hopefully have some fun, jump out again, let's do some more math in another chapter. So it's got a different style and a different pace. And just reaches a slightly different audience, I think.
I think that point about reaching different audiences, because I think that it's there is, because of all these elements of math, just talking about the jumbo vision numbers, and there's also references to taxicab numbers and so on. There's all these references that can be made, and each one of them can be explained just on its own terms, but it can also draw in a bigger topic. So for anybody sitting there, these are, in one sense, these are incredibly advanced ideas in terms of number theory, or they're touching on things and they show you things, but they're accessible. There's kind of like a ground floor elevator there.
Yeah, and you can get to quite a difficult, challenging level, and then bang, it's the end of a chapter and you're off again. So if you've got slight, if a reader has got, and I hate it if I've left a reader confused, because then I haven't done my job properly. My background was in television before I was a writer. And so when you write for television or when you make TV shows, clarity is really important. Drama is important. You've got to hook people in. You don't want people picking up the TV remote and switching channels. So I've always tried to write in that same style of keeping the audience on board. Repeating an idea if I have to, explaining it in a second way if that's going to help the reader. But in the Simpsons book, if it does get a little bit too tricky, bang, we're away onto another chapter anyway. Yeah. So it doesn't matter.
It's like buses. There'll be another chapter along, and there'll be another idea along, and that'll treat you in a very different way. And that's it. Now, just thought that comes out of that. There's a lot here about communication. Portraying maths, trying to show people perhaps a side of maths they hadn't appreciated, but also connecting with people who are seeing maths, but perhaps not—they're not being presented with enough maths, as it were, for their own lifestyle. And that seems to relate. That seems to be a kind of constant theme that is now taking you into a sort of a different direction at the moment. You're doing some masterclasses online, I've seen on Twitter.
So the thing that I'm really excited about now. The thing that I spend most of my time thinking about is, I was really lucky. I kind of went to I grew up in Somerset. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in London. I live in Bristol. I'm county next door. I live in Bristol.
Right. But, so you've come from here to Bristol. I've come from kind of Bristol area.
It's a fair swap.
Where I grew up, we used to have these things called direct grant schools. So if you pass the 11 plus exam, you've got to go to the direct grant school. And I had really good math teachers. And we had like a 10 or 15 of us who were quite strong mathematicians and people who were certainly stronger than me. And so I always found math challenging and difficult. And that was good because it stretched me and it prepared me for going to university and, mm-hmm. and everything I did afterwards. And my feeling today is that if you're pretty good at maths, like I was and other people in my year, then the maths at school is not that hard and it's not necessarily that interesting. And GCSEs, which you know, we have here in the UK, are fairly straightforward if you're good at maths. Yeah. If you're not that good at maths, they're very challenging. But if you are, it's not really very interesting. So schools have got 200 kids to worry about in a certain year. And if you've got kids at the top who are doing really well, not surprisingly, you'll focus on the other 190 because some of them are going to really need a lot of help.
Yeah.
So the challenge that I'm interested in is how do you help those 10 at the top go from being good mathematicians, really good mathematicians, into excellent mathematicians, people who can build their futures and build their careers on their mathematics. And although we've talked about mathematics over and over again, and I'm talking about mathematics now, what I'm really talking about is thinking about difficult problems and learning some of that determination and grit and enjoying difficulty and enjoying about thinking about how you problem solve so that those students are prepared, not just for A-level, but prepared for university and computer science or engineering or physics or cosmology or mathematics. So anyway, I've been thinking about this for about 7 or 8 years and trying different models and different approaches. And the model that we're working on at the moment is we start with kids who are about 12 years old in what we call year seven. And they join us online once a week in groups of six. So we have 500 at the moment who join us and in groups of six. And we challenge them with maths every week. And we'll do it throughout their year seven, throughout their 12th year, age 12, and then for the next 5 years. So it's not a short-term intervention. It's not a summer camp. It's not an after-school guest lecture. It's week after week after week, year after year after year. So they really build a knowledge base, but also an ability and a confidence and a love of tackling difficult problems. Mm. And a playfulness with maths as well. And so we've only just started in the last couple of years, but my hope is that we can, you know, half of our students, all of our students are in the top 1 or 2% of their year. So they're all pretty good. And half of them are from disadvantaged backgrounds, kind of backgrounds that are really underrepresented when it comes to STEM. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that we're going to increase, you know, not just the number of excellent mathematicians, but also the diversity of excellent mathematicians as well. So it's been really interesting to get this up and running and to see this new cohort of mathematicians grow week by week.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that you're not attempting any kind of short-term snap kind of intervention. Yeah. This is this very continuous build up. And I think that must be, from the kids' point of view, I think that's where the confidence is going to come from and that engagement. It's not just a...
And they can be from anywhere in the country because we're doing it all online. They get to meet other mathsy kind of kids of their age doing equally difficult problems. And, you know, they turn up every week, which is terrific. And so I'm really excited about... And we're going to add other things as well. We're going to add kind of guest lectures and we're going to have chess tournaments and we're going to, just talking to you earlier, I'd like to add a coding element. So, you know, you turn up every week, you do the maths, that's what we're here for. But, hey, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? If certain kids from certain families at certain schools, they're switched onto Numberphile. I don't know if you watch Numberphile.
Yes, Numberphile, wonderful. You know,
they've had like half a billion views of maths videos.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary success, but not all kids realize it's there. Not all kids realize that actually, if you really love maths, you can go on and watch maths videos.
Yeah.
They've also got a channel called Computer File Six Symbols Physics Channel.
Yes.
So one is getting them to think about these maths ideas, but two, it's about saying, look, these are all the other resources that you can explore. Mm. that are open to you if you're curious and ambitious.
Yeah, I think that's showing that connection is really important. Connecting maths to everything, but also saying, yeah, you can go out and find this. This is all out there. Yeah. And it's a case of looking. And I think there's, and from the other point of view is, meeting other people and seeing other people like yourself is always for kids who might feel a little bit on the edge, pushed to the edge in one way or another, being able to see yourself and other people. It's like, oh, it's not just me. Yeah. There's somebody else who geeks out over this as well. And they're like me in other ways. And it's just like, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
The slight challenge is for some of those kids, they will have been at the top of the class and there'll be in a group of six where they're kind of in the middle and they're not always quickest to the answer. And I think it's better that they learn that when they're 12 than they hit that brick wall when they're 18 or 17. The other kids can do stuff quicker than them, but maybe they're going to be quicker at the geometry or whatever it is. We can all just get better together. We can, and getting things wrong is the point at which you start learning stuff.
And I think that's easier to do in this longer format. And also, if you're going to be disillusioned about anything, about your own position in the world, best to get that one in early or to understand, actually, you know, there are other people. I'm not, you know, again, it's I'm not alone. That kind of recalibrates that. I think I'm just going to end on one or two other small notes because that I did notice. One of the things is that you start the Simpsons book on chapter zero, which as a programmer is wonderful from my point of view.
It was
one of those things. I'm highly sensitized. Does the book begin with a chapter zero? Or does it, I've written a book which begins with a chapter zero, and I thought he wrote with a chapter zero. It's just but that's not a programming book. So what can you remember why you did that?
No idea. That's
lost to history. Oh no.
No, I mean the thing. So I haven't written. So that was my last book, I think. Last book in terms of the last book that I've written, but probably my last book full stop. I don't have any other ideas for books to write. I came across the Simpsons idea in about 2007. And I was fired up about it. And that's when I first emailed David X. Cohen and the first time I got in touch with the writers. And then I got really angry and upset about alternative medicine and some of the dangerous claims that were being made. And I just thought, I've got to write this book first because I'm just really frustrated and angry about it. The Trickle Treatment about alternative medicine. It's not a book that goes out to destroy alternative medicine. I co-wrote it with a professor of complementary medicine. And our mission was to look at all of the different therapies for all the different conditions and to evaluate the evidence.
Yeah.
And just to say to people what works, not very much. What doesn't work, what's safe, and what's dangerous.
What's dangerous, yes. Yeah. I think that's
And so I had to get that out of my system first. And it's very different from all my other books because my other books tend to be, you know, how great is cosmology? How great is maths? This was very much a case of challenging bad science rather than celebrating great science. But once I got that out of my system, I got back to writing about The Simpsons. And I just don't have any other ideas where I think I've got to go away and write that. I'm not necessarily looking for those ideas. I also think there's so much brilliant stuff that's online for free. You know, when I started writing, we didn't have number file. We didn't have long form blogs. It's a completely different landscape. And whereas in the past, I'd be happy to set aside 2, 3, 4 years to work on a book in the hope that it might do really well. I've kind of now reached age where I don't want to risk spending 3 or 4 years writing a book where I kind of know, I've written a book before and I know how that works. I don't think I'm going to learn very much. I don't think necessarily the audience is going to learn very much either because I've kind of written about all the things I want to write about. Whereas if I can get this math thing to work, if we can get, you know, 1,000 kids every year joining our project and going into that pipeline, and if we can, you know, export the model to other countries because it clearly works. If it works here, it'll work anywhere. Then that to me seems like a more interesting and more useful thing to do.
I'm just thinking, you know, there's all kinds of puns that come to mind. I mean, you know, you started with Fermat's Last Theorem, and that's so the Simpsons and the Mathematical Curiosity, you know,
secret, sorry, is effectively Simon's last book, is what we're saying. It's nicely bookended there, quite literally. So you heard it here first, folks. And I think on that note, thank you very much, Simon. This has been excellent. I could do this for hours. There's a lot of notes that I have on mathematical geekery. That's all there is time for, I'm afraid, folks. I should do that with a kind of not, it's not quite Simpsons, really. It's Warner Brothers. You know, that's all, folks. But thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech for lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.